You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. I'm very pleased to be presenting a program with David L. Ulan and Vivian Gornick. It's going to be a real treat. I don't know, how many of you walked here tonight? Okay, we have some pedestrians. That's great. I remember a few years ago we had an author here from England, Will Self, who actually walked from LAX to the library. I was like, really? And I also remember the day I walked out of on the Hope Street side of the library, and there was a gentleman who came up to me and said, "How do I walk to Pomona?" And I don't think that's possible. But and then he disappeared. And then I thought, there's got to be a way. There's always got to be a way. Nothing is impossible. So tonight we're going to talk. Vivian Gornick is the author of the acclaimed memoir Fierce Attachments, about her childhood in the Bronx and her lifelong antagonism with her mother, a biography of Emma Goldman, and three essay collections, two of which, The Men in My Life and The End of the Novel of Love, were finalists for the National Book Critics Circle Award. She was a reporter for The Village Voice, where she was assigned or asked to be assigned to cover the feminist movement, whose insights would strongly influence her work. And her most recent book, the memoir The Odd Woman and the City, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. David L. Ulan, you've probably seen David interviewing other people on the stage, so it'll be fun to ask questions of him for a change. He's the author or editor of 8 previous books, including The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time, and the Library of America's Writing Los Angeles, a literary anthology. He's a 2015 Guggenheim Fellow and the former book critic and book editor of the Los Angeles Times. And his most recent book is Sidewalking, Coming to Terms with Los Angeles, which we will try to do on some limited scale tonight. So please join me in welcoming Vivian Gornick and David L. Ulan. Well, it's really fun to sit around in a cafe and to talk to two New Yorkers, because you both really are New Yorkers, aren't you? Admit it, David, you are.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a man without a country.
Well, welcome. Vivian, I was just thinking that we all have this connection to New York. You were born there and moved out here. Vivian, you're a lifelong New Yorker, right?
I'm a lifer, yes.
Oh, you're a lifer. I'm the daughter of two New Yorkers who came to Los Angeles after the war, so I've always had that tie to New York. So, and your books they have wonderful similarities. And where is Vivian's book with my notes in it? Excuse me, I have to go.
Oh.
I'm going to have to make a run for the green room at some point and find it. Tell me a little bit, you're the daughter of immigrants, right?
Yes.
How are you a New Yorker? When did they come to New York, your family?
Oh, well, my parents came to New York around the First World War.
Thank you.
Around 1912 and 1914. And they lived classically on the Lower East Side, and then they moved to the Bronx, and I was born in the Bronx, and we lived in a completely Jewish working-class immigrant neighborhood. And for them, actually, for my parents, Manhattan was a very iffy situation. My father went to work in Manhattan, but like all working men who could hardly speak English and was still felt very ill, unassured in this country, all he did was get on the subway, hang from a strap, get off at 38th Street, work in a factory, get back on the subway, and come home. For both of them, Manhattan was a fearful place. It was not a place of authority. It was not a place where they could feel completely unafraid. But I, and everybody like me, started riding the subway when I was 14, and even earlier. But for us, for me, it was 14, and we all did this. And as I've written in this book, we were like, as if we'd come from Kansas You know, being born and raised in the Bronx in that homogeneous atmosphere and full of fear and shadow, Manhattan was Araby. Manhattan was where you were. Manhattan was where you were going to come of age, where you were going to make your mark. You know, I don't have to tell you. It was glamour, excitement. It was everything under the sun. So, but instead of being from Kansas, I was from the Bronx. So I could go back every evening. You know, I'd spend a whole day in Manhattan, and then I'd go back waiting for life to begin. So that was the experience of most kids like me.
And David, you grew up in Manhattan, right?
I grew up in Manhattan. I'm the next generation. So that's my parents
you
were...
Are. Thank you.
Grandparents came.
Right, like my parents.
Both my parents were raised in Brooklyn, although my father moved, his family moved out to Long Island right after the war. They were part of the first migration out to the island, and they could not wait to get out of Brooklyn, right? I mean, they, even to this day, my father, at one point, when Barclays Center opened, Barbara Streisand opened the Barclays Center, and my mother said to my father, "I really want to go." And he said, "When she comes to Manhattan, we'll go."
Right.
So this is leading me into this thought about the persona that you've created in both of these books. Vivian, in her wonderful memoir, The Situation and the Story, her book of essays about memoir writing, talks about the creation of a memoir, the creation of persona in both memoir and essay, and perhaps... Vivian's book is more memoir, yours might be more essay, but the boundaries blur. I mean, there's elements of both, I would say, in them, but you both have constructed a persona. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, coming from this different background, who is the persona, who is speaking, who is the narrator in your different memoirs? Let's start with you, David.
The narrator is a construction, a heightened version of me. I don't believe, I mean, I talk about this in classes all the time. I believe that the first person character in a piece of nonfiction is first and foremost a character and has to exist on the page as a character. So, in some way, consciously or unconsciously, it's not a fully conscious process. I'm trying to create a version of myself on the page. When people who really know me read my first person writing, when people who really know me, like the people who live with me, they always say, you know, you're really presenting, you're really putting your best face forward there. I was like, yes, because it's a book. You know, people don't want to read about the petty squabbles.
Maybe so.
No, they do, but not in, you know. So there's an idea, so there's that. But for me, it's a questioning. I mean, in this book in particular, it's a first-person voice that is asking questions. I'm really interested in questions. I'm not really that interested in answers. And so that persona is a questioning persona who is also, because it is, there are memoir elements, but it's not a memoir, is also trying to engage in conversation both with the physical space of the city, with the kind of emotional space of memory, and I think with the mental space of other voices and other writers.
And he said it all. actually, The Situation and the Story is not a memoir. It is a book that grew out of 15 years of teaching and reading and writing, nonfiction writing, what I call the personal narrative, which is really essentially memoirs. But calling it personal narrative has come to feel easier for me to connect with than the memoir, because they give us so much trouble. Because the memoir is not—it's not a transcription. It's not—it's not a confession in the analyst's office. It's not a police blotter. It is a construction. It's a composed story with a piece of experience at the center, and the object of the exercise is to shape that piece of experience. So the memoirist has exactly the same responsibility as a poet or a novelist, except that the narrator, the I, is clearly the writer. Beyond that, now, who is that writer? As David has said, you pull from yourself somebody, yourself, but not yourself at the same time, and not necessarily your best self, but a coherent self, mm-hmm. which you are not at all, ever. Right? That coherent self serves what you think is the experience. That coherent self requires a tone of voice, a vocabulary, a way of seeing things that in itself pushes the story forward. So, for instance, I did write a memoir many years ago called Fierce Attachments. It was about me and my mother and a woman who lived next door to us when I was a child, growing up in the Bronx. I started to write that story as if I was telling the story in the past, when I was 8 years old, 10, or growing up between these two women. And at first I thought these two women made me a woman. So I went on like that. And soon I discovered I had a lot of unfinished business with my mother, and that wasn't sufficient. And then one day, am I taking too long?
No, it's fine.
I just got to tell you how a persona gets developed in this case. One day my mother called me up. We walked all the time, no matter how angry we were with each other. We were never estranged, and we were always walking the streets of New York. She loved to walk as much, if not more, than me. So one day she calls me up, and she tells me she's out walking, and she's standing at the corner, and a seven-year-old kid, a kid who looked 7 years old to her, standing beside her, and a little girl suddenly starts to dart across the street on the red light. My mother yanks her back and says, "Darling, you don't cross on the red, you cross on the green." The kid looks up at my mother and says, "Lady, you got the whole thing upside down." So my mother says to me, "That kid is not going to live to 8. So that was me and Mom on the street. So I wanted to, I had hit a real dead end. I couldn't go on with this book. And I decided that this amused me and I would write it out. But in order for me to think that a reader would understand its meaning, I had to set it up. So I had to set it up with me and Mama walking and this and that. And by the end of it, I saw that I had goals. I had the structure. I was in the past with my mother and Nettie. And then I was on the street as we were now with each other. And I came to understand that in time, these two sets of women were going to account for themselves to each other. Mm. And then as I went on, I learned even more that it wasn't about them making me a woman. It was about me, my not being able to leave my mother because I had become my mother. So that took a lot of learning. And when I did, it all went back to the beginning and I rewrote everything. With the idea in mind that this was the daughter writing. The woman who could not leave her mother was the narrator. And everything went into that. And that has had to happen for every single piece of nonfiction, I believe, that is worth anything. The rest, you know, just go down. All right?
So the two of you are, these books are kind of focus on, I mean, walking is a through line through the book. And
in this case, yeah.
In these books. And the question is, why do you walk? Why do you walk? And you both answer that in several times in your narratives in different ways. And I thought it'd be lovely to hear it in your voice. So, David, perhaps you could read from the beginning.
I did manage to successfully bring glasses.
That's good.
The last reading I did, I did not bring glasses, and I was like, I can't see a damn thing. So I thought I would avoid that problem.
Pretty good. And if the galley has mistakes, that's okay.
That's part of the galley process. There's always mistakes. So this is just, I guess, the first, I write long paragraphs, so this is the first paragraph. We'll be done in 20 minutes. There's a church I like on Cochrane Avenue. Little street corner church, adobe style, like a mission in some minor key. I discovered it during a walk in the neighborhood, one of the interminable loops by which I mark my place in this city, east on Packard, out to Cochrane, south toward Pico, and back around, the whole thing one vast circle, a walkabout, a song line, a way to meander my universe into being. Then one afternoon I broke the pattern, and rather than heading south, I went north where I found the church. This morning, going against all convention, I turned right instead of left, Sven Burkitt's writes in The Other Walk, describing his own inadvertent rewiring of a common saunter. Going against the grain of my usual track, seeing every single thing from the other side was suddenly welcome. Suddenly welcome, yes, but also, for me at least, a means of turning the walk into a journey of discovery again. We walk, or I do, to pay attention. to see the streets, the buildings that surround us, to immerse ourselves in a world that might otherwise slip by. And yet, the paradox is that the more we walk, the less we notice, the more the passing landscape blurs to indistinction, like the backdrop in a Roadrunner cartoon. That's especially true of Los Angeles, this 35-mile-per-hour city, where the very notion of the street as public space remains alien somehow. I think of Joan Didion. A good part of any day in Los Angeles is spent driving alone through streets devoid of meaning to the driver, which is one reason the place exhilarates some people and floods others with an amorphous unease. She's right, of course. Although what she neglects to say is just how institutionalized this process is, in a city where we can leave our homes and drive to work, to dinner, to the movies, without ever stepping outside.
Your town.
And for a blast of New York, Vivian, how about this section that starts with "The street keeps you moving"?
Oh. The street keeps moving, and you've got to love the movement. You got to find the composition of the rhythm, lift the story from the motion, understand and not regret the power of narrative drive is fragile, though infinite. Civilization is breaking up. The city is deranged. The century surreal. Move faster. Find the storyline more quickly. On the 6th Avenue bus, I get up to give an old woman my seat. She's small and blonde, wearing gold jewelry and a ratty mink coat. Her hands a pair of blotchy claws with long red fingernails attached to them. "You did a good thing, dear," she says to me and smiles coyly. "I'm 90 years old. I was 90 yesterday." I smile at her. "You look fantastic," I say. "Not a day over 75. Her eyes flash. "Don't get smart," she says. At a coffee counter, two women sit talking at right angles to me. One is telling the other that a woman they both know is sleeping with a much younger man. "We all tell her he wants your money." The woman speaking nods her head like a rag doll and lets her face go daffy in imitation of the woman she's speaking of. "Right," she tells us, "and he can have it, all of it." Meanwhile, she looks great. At 42nd Street, a man in front of me, skinny, young, black, suddenly lies down, spread eagle in the middle of the street, just as the cars are beginning to move. I turn wildly to the man walking beside me, who, as it happens, is also skinny, young, black, and cry out at him, "Why is he doing this?" Without breaking his stride, he shrugs at me. "I don't know, lady. Maybe he's depressed." Each day when I leave the house, I tell myself I'm going to walk up the east side of town because the east side is calmer, cleaner, more spacious. Yet I seem always to find myself on the crowded, filthy, volatile west side. On the west side, life feels positively thematic. All that intelligence trapped inside all those smarts. It reminds me of why I walk, why everyone walks. Mm. We're both saying everyone.
So if we pause for a minute and just think about those two passages and how emblematic they are of these two cities and these two people,
yes.
Let's just talk about that a little bit. I mean, David, what strikes me in that passage is, I mean, you alone on the sidewalk, you know, seeing things and evoking the even more alone sense of being in a car. And Vivian, I see you, you know, moving through these, you know, these crowds of people. And how does that really get into the writing itself? How would you say that really moves into your writing?
Well, didn't you hear us?
Yeah. No, but I mean, what does it say? I mean, to you about the city in that way. What do you hear in that?
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I mean, I think for me, I'm always operating. I mean, I am alone. I don't mean I'm alone and, you know, whatever. But I mean, I am alone. We're all alone. So I operate out of an existential posture of being alone, generally speaking. I mean, in life in general. So I think that, you know, we write out of whatever those kinds of positions are.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for me, in some way, that was not at all conscious when I moved to Los Angeles, I identify with place in many ways more than I identify with people. And so I identified very strongly with New York as someone who grew up in New York and with certain aspects of existing in a city. And the other cities that I lived in before coming to Los Angeles, primarily San Francisco, I also kind of felt familiar to me in certain ways because they operated according to kind of the rule structure of New York. When I got to Los Angeles, I had no idea where I was. So in that idea of I walk to find out where I am, I actually do. I walk to kind of root myself in a place. I walk to kind of walk myself into a sense of being. And I walk also as a way of engaging with memory. The memory can be personal or collective. Originally, the idea for this book was to write a Los Angeles version of Alfred Kazin's, I was heavily inspired by Alfred Kazin's book, A Walker in the City. But the difference is Kazin grew up in Brooklyn, which that book is about, and in many ways it's a coming-of-age memoir through the filter of walking. Right. I didn't grow up here, so my my roots are thin, or shallow, let's say. And so I decided I wanted to explore that kind of condition of shallow roots, of learning my way, learning how to be an Angeleno in a certain sense. But I also think that it's a set of accommodations. I think in the book I say, you know, the city forces us to reimagine ourselves in its image, but we also reimagine the city in our image. And that's part of the relationship. So I'm really interested in, I guess I am kind of misanthropic. I mean, we talked about this and you disagreed, but I'm much more interested in a relationship with place than I am in a relationship with people.
Yeah, that's true.
And so that sense of how do I find my identity in this place and what does this place mean to me, this place where I have first inadvertently and then by choice made my life, that those are the driving.
But you're also slowing yourself down so that you can see it. I mean, we also talk about the blur that Los Angeles can be, particularly when we're driving, so that when you are out of your car and you're walking, you really are putting yourself in the place in a way.
In a
like,
very
what am I seeing?
In a know? Very physical, direct way. I also think for me that I needed to figure out a way to, when I first got here, the city seemed indefinable and incredibly chaotic, which I think it is. And I think that actually is kind of one of the thrills of the city. But initially, I had to figure out a way to bound it in some way where I could make sense of it or make sense of myself within it. And so walking, because that was my natural vernacular, my natural urban vernacular, seemed to be, again, it sounds more conscious than it was. I just walked. The actual fact, you know, which is in the book as well, is that when we first moved here, we had one car. And my wife had a straight job, and I didn't, so she got the car. So I basically, if I wanted to go anywhere, I had to either walk or wait till she got home. And, you know, I got bored, so I started, you know, it just seemed like a natural way to walk. It didn't seem unnatural at all to me to walk a mile and a half to some place because I was used to that. But then in the experience of walking a mile and a half in Los Angeles was quite different than walking a mile and a half in a different city, if only because I wasn't encountering a lot of people on the street.
Whereas, Vivian, you are kind of, those encounters are revelatory to you.
Oh, mine is my walking isn't a history that goes back to Addison Steele. My walking is the urban experience as it has ever been known, and especially since the 19th century. I mean, Samuel Johnson walked the streets of London in the 1740s to dispel daily depression and all the rest of it, and had many, many friends who did exactly the same thing and said, and it was a disgusting city filled with sewage and pestilence and men cutting each other's throats in alleys at midnight. And he said, the man who is tired of London is tired of life. So from that time on, the crowd has been growing. I set out to write this book in order to contribute to the literature of urban life. You know, it's all been men. I saw myself as this middle-aged, divorced feminist walking the streets of a great city. And I wanted that to be the spine of the book that I eventually wrote, which took me a very long time to bring into shape. But it was just that. It was exactly that. It was what Johnson suffered, for instance, the sense of alienation, of loneliness, of depression, of anxiety, everything we all suffer from in a quite garden variety way, right? Every one of us who walks the streets of a city is in that position. And you walk in order to relieve it. There's no question about that. None. I mean, I know walkers. And everyone, and the crowd, the anonymous crowd that is constantly interacting with you, returns you to a sense of humanity. And I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. And New York, of course, is one of the great cities of the world where one can do this. London, Paris is the city in which Walter Benjamin and Baudelaire identified the condition. They saw the meaning of the modern crowd, and they saw the crowd as the first readers, by the way. But they saw the crowd as doing exactly that. And Gissing, I think, George Gissing said it in one of his books. He describes the astonishing sensation of seeing someone from the side or quickly or just a gesture, a motion, a face that is hardly seen, a voice that you can't identify when you turn around. And the meaning, the thrill and the threat and the adjustment to all of that, to see life that you can't capture. Somewhere else in this book, I talk about don't grab at connection because connection keeps on repeating itself.
And also seeing yourself. You talk about seeing yourself yes. reflected in the eye of a stranger.
Absolutely.
And I don't know, when you're walking in the city, David, I mean, you seem like you're in a dialogue with the history of the city as much as you are with encountering people.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, certainly. I mean, it's interesting because I also think longing is part of it. I think back, like, a memory, you know, one of my most vivid memories of adolescence, for instance, is of making eye contact. I was about 15, of making eye contact with a girl about the same age through the closed window of a subway. I was on the platform, uh-huh. She was on the train, and...
It's so noir, right?
It's so noir.
And I don't know. Who knows, you know? I remain convinced all these years later that there was something there, even though it was, you know, a split second. In that way, it is that same kind of catching the, you know. And that memory has lingered with me, unlike most memories of being 15 years old. So there's that part of it. I mean, I think for me, again, part of my... I don't want to overuse the word or overemphasize the word, but part of my... sort of intention in the book was to explore a kind of intentional quality of exile, in a sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I chose to move here. I have enjoyed living here quite a lot, but I have had to come to terms with the city. And so I think, you know, I think for me the difference is when I am walking in New York, I feel like I'm immediately plugged into my native language. In Los Angeles, I feel like I'm fluent, but, you know, I'm constantly translating a little bit. So the walking becomes, I think for me, walking is different
depending
on where I walk.
You walk to increase a sense of exile?
No, I walk to mitigate a sense of exile. I walk to increase a sense of place. But I think that, again, for me, and it is partly also because I think Los Angeles... You know, there are certainly many areas of Los Angeles that are walking areas. I wouldn't make the case that Los Angeles is a great walking city, although I think you can do great walking in Los Angeles. But I think that for me, partly because there isn't that kind of sense of the crowd on the street, unless I'm walking in Koreatown or in downtown or, you know, neighborhoods where there is... where there is a lot of street life. But, it, you know, in my neighborhood where there isn't that much street life, I'm walking more for a kind of... a relationship or a deepening of a sense of place.
Now, Vivian, you have a companion. I don't know how much you and Leonard do the walking together or just talk about it, reevaluate, but tell us
Leonard
a little bit
Corlin.
About Leonard, who's quite
Why?
A character.
I mean, what do you want to know?
Well, tell people who he is. Not everyone here has read the book. Who is Leonard? He's your friend.
They haven't read the book at all. So
some people have. Oh, some people have.
Okay, Leonard.
You don't know.
This book is a collage. It is composed of three identifiable strands of interest. One is friendship. One is a particular friendship, and then friendship in general. One is the city, and the third is me trying to make sense of my life through friendship and the city, right? So Leonard is the name I give to a very old friend of mine, a man who's been my closest friend for many, many years. He's gay. I am the odd woman. Odd woman is derived from George Gissing's novel called The Odd Women. And just very quickly, you know, the modern women's movement begins in the French Revolution with Mary Wollstonecraft and the Vindication of the Rights of Women. And then every 50 years since then, it raises its ugly little head and we go forward two steps and back one step. And each time around, we're called something different. Free women, new women, liberated women. But Gissing nailed it. He called us the odd women, by which he meant the women who could not make their peace with the world as it is. And I felt when I read The Odd Women that he just got my generation completely. And above all, he created a set of characters who struggle to become the new people, the new man and the new woman, and they fail miserably. And it's a stark demonstration of the gap between practice and theory. So I'm the odd woman. Leonard is gay. And so we both feel that we have suffered social inequity, that we were born into social inequity, right? And we made a lot of use of it. So the question we would ask ourselves in time was, would we have created some other kind of social inequity if we'd not had the ones that were ready-made for us? You know what I mean? Okay. So that is what our relationship is devoted to, and it's that I make use of in this book. Leonard and I, it's not that we walk together, although sometimes we do, but mainly it's just that we meet in this book once a week for 20 years, take a walk, have dinner, see a movie, etc. And we have these conversations that demonstrate the nature of this friendship, which is that we are, how do I say this, that we are witnessing each other's lives.
And you are both creatures of the city.
And we are absolutely children of the city. We're both working class. We both come from the Bronx. We both have spent endless hours talking about our mothers. We are children of the city, absolutely. And he was a great walker himself. I give him a lot of that. That's the most important thing. That's how we see ourselves. But that is only one part of the thing that I can make use of eventually in this book. But I work this very strongly.
And David, one of the people that you kind of sort of have a subtle dialogue with through your book, I think, is Norman Klein.
Yes.
And I feel like he's a very interesting presence.
Another expatriate New York Jew, right?
But I remember there's a part that really jumped out at me where, you know, he said, I'm going to pick the ugliest corner in the city. And he describes this corner in the valley. He says there's like an automotive repair. Like,
right.
There's all these things. It's like it looks like it's just Nowhereville. And it turns out, tell us.
It turns out to be, now I'm going to forget because it's been a while since I wrote it. It's a Lebanese neighborhood, a Palestinian neighborhood.
It's all of them.
It's all of them. And what, I mean, do you guys know Norman's work? Does anybody, you guys?
The right, History of Forgetting.
So Norman Klein, who teaches at CalArts, who's, you know, one of the rare geniuses of the world, wrote this book called The History of Forgetting, which is a kind of anti-history of Los Angeles. I met him because he used to take graduate students on anti-tours. And basically he would rent a bus and take people to places where things used to be, right? This used to be the Brown Derby. This used to be, you know, they were never there. It was great. And it was really fun to watch the confusion that it generated. This is part of the argument. I mean, there are many arguments in the history of forgetting, but one of the arguments that he makes... this was actually from did I ever tell you, I need the glasses again, sorry. Did I ever tell you about the ugliest place in Los Angeles? Klein once asked me apropos of nothing. He also is a great riffer, so often he will ask you things apropos of nothing. I decided it was in Van Nuys at the intersection of Fulton and Burbank. I selected it because it wasn't poverty. It was just ugly, retinal eye burn of an extreme form. On one corner was a place called Father and Me, which repaired cars. It was surrounded by rolls of barbed wire like some old lady's hair. Across the street was a very bad trompe l'oeil lumber yard that looked like it was going to fall over. Then there was this strange Middle Eastern restaurant in a dumpy building with a faded image on top of a man holding a chicken. It was like that in every direction. Eventually, Klein discovered that beneath this desolate veneer of blankness were overlapping populations of Lebanese and Palestinians and Israelis. A map of the Middle East emerged. Little by little, he concluded this was not the ugliest place in Los Angeles. It was just the best erased example of urban complexity. And I thought, wow, this is one crazy city to have that much happening with so little heat you can actually see. So I think, you know, one of the things that Norman taught me was that Los Angeles is, you got to look below the surface, right? This is a city that is consistently defined by its surfaces, both from the outside in a denigrating way, right? We are constantly written off as, you know, the superficial city, the city with no depth, glitz, glam. We could probably have a group recitation of all the cliches. But also in some way in terms of how we live here, because if we are operating in that 35 mile an hour time frame or that 35 mile through that 35 mile an hour filter, we don't look, we don't see what's there.
No.
And we don't actually understand. I mean, Los Angeles, I've come to believe partly through writing this book that all the cliches are true and their inverse is also true. And so, you know, this is a city of sprawl, yeah. Absolutely, but it is also profoundly and fundamentally a city of neighborhoods.
Well,
and that's part of what Norman is saying.
This is a city that one has to go looking for.
You have to go looking for.
Yeah, I worked for 2 years in Houston, Texas, and there were a lot of people who loved Houston. I did not, as you can imagine, and I couldn't find anything there. It was the same thing. The streets were empty of people. That was it. I didn't see anything. But I had a lot of friends from New York who were also working there periodically. And they found marvelous things, just as you say. They found the right neighborhoods. They found the museum. They found they just found everything. From Minneapolis to the Pacific, I think most cities are like that. And from Minneapolis east, we're cities in the old-fashioned mold.
Right. And a city in which mode, I love this phrase, Vivian, you say, most people are in New York because they need evidence in large quantities of human expressiveness, and they need it not now and then, but every day. I mean, a city of human expressiveness. And, I mean, that's not how I would define Los Angeles, but it's here.
No.
It's here, and it depends. I mean, for me, one of the great transformations was, for about 5 years, I lived in Pico Robertson, which is an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I say in the book, when my mother came to visit me the first time, she said, "Oh, you've moved to Brooklyn in the 1940s. which was true. I was like, "Yeah, we even have the Dodgers. It's perfect." But
that's right.
but it was a neighborhood where people walked all the time because it was, or not all the time, but walked a lot because it was Orthodox. And on Friday night, I would be out. You know, I'd come out of my house, yeah. And I'd see people walking to shul, and that, you know, and there was something really profound. I was aware that there were neighborhoods, but I never really viscerally felt the sense of neighborhood until I lived as an apostate Jew in that Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. I felt like part of the community, even though I wasn't part of the community.
And that is
very much, I mean, there's a lot of street life in that, you know. But in that way, it's a very narrowly bounded community. And so it opened up that sense of perception. But you do have to either be looking for it, or for me at least, I spend enough time on the ground to actually
and listening for it.
I
remember Wanda Coleman on this stage talking about the rhythm of Los Angeles. You know, what is the rhythm of Los Angeles? And I think we hear it in different ways in different places in the city, but it's there. But you really have to listen. And New York, it's
just there.
It's just there. You don't have to,
like any world capital.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Sorry. What's wrong?
It's
okay.
Is
something wrong? Isn't it? What?
I wanted to talk a little bit about the way the two of you use a sense of overlay of different states of being in your book, sometimes historical, sometimes from your own life. And I wonder, you have this beautiful passage, Vivian, if you would read it about Washington Square Park.
Oh, no, right, you said. Okay. I actually squirm over this passage.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I don't know why. Well, you'll tell me why.
Okay.
I thought a lot
about
that.
That's why she looked askance when I said I was going to ask her to read it.
It's an evening in June, and I am taking a turn through Washington Square. As I stroll, I see in the air before me, like an image behind a scrim, the square as it looked when I was young, standing right behind the square that I'm actually looking at. That was a good 50 years ago, when my friends and I used to come down from the Bronx and in from Brooklyn on summer evenings, and we'd walk around looking at a piece of world so different from that of our own neighborhoods, we might as well have been in Europe. The square was pristine then, paths swept clean, benches freshly painted, fountain sparkling, and the verdancy a marvel, thousands of leaves glistening on the century-old trees, every bush and flower bed neatly trimmed, the grass green velvet, and the people in the square. It was middle-class bohemia then, forgetting. Mm. The women sensual, the men poetic, and of course everyone white. To our hungry young eyes, the scene promised culture and class privilege. Not a thought in our heads then about race or sex. We couldn't wait to get there. Romantic longing washed through all of us for years, and we were haunted by the beauty of the square on those sweet summer evenings. Now, here it is another summer evening, and I am again walking in the square, with the street at my back and everything I know etched on my face. I look through the scrim directly into those old memories, and I see that they no longer have authority over me. I see the square as it is, black, brown, young, swarming with drifters and junkies and lousy guitar players. And I feel myself as I am, the city as it is. I have lived out my conflicts, not my fantasies, and so has New York. We are one.
Mm. That's beautiful. I love that.
We are at one.
And David, maybe you could read the second part of the church.
Okay. So this
again, thinking about overlay.
Right. So this kind of comes back to some of the things I was taught. Where am I? I'm reading to...
Right there. Where did you stop?
I'm reading to here. Okay. So this kind of comes back to what we're talking about. All right. So you remember the church, right? Anyway, the church. I fell for it the moment I saw it on the corner of Cochrane and Packard, built into the slow slope of a hill. There was the dome of the bell tower, faded gilt, stained glass windows, brown as mica, the building stretching back half a block or so, deceptive in its depth. Even more, there was the way it fit into the neighborhood, or not the neighborhood exactly, but the block. East of the church was what looked like a low-slung rectory, and just beyond that, a two-story apartment house, 8 units maybe, pallid stucco, flat and hulking, with a red-tiled roof. All three buildings looked as though they'd been put up in the 1930s, that golden age of California urban architecture, utilitarian and beautiful at once. This is the California of my first infatuation, imprinted when I was 18 and living in San Francisco, a city I once wandered like a mendicant, memorizing its sidewalks through the soles of my feet. I remember coming upon block after block, much like this one, apartments next to street corner churches. In San Francisco, the buildings were bigger, 4 or 5 stories, and cleaner, framing the Marina or Pacific Heights in blinding white. Still, there was something about this streetscape, its whisper of density, which brought me back to all those peregrinations through that other city, the randomness, the serendipity of urban space. Above the buildings, the sky was hooded, overcast, San Francisco weather, as if a fog were moving in. If I squinted, I could almost see it, one city bleeding through another, an imago, an unexpected trace. Now we're going to, you'll hear my mother is in this part, the same thing. So sorry to repeat myself. This is what I love about cities, the way that even the most distinct of them resembles one another when you least expect it, the way the lines between memory and imagination blur. When I was a kid, listening to my grandfather reminisce about the glory days of Flatbush, I used to regret with a child's peculiar secondhand nostalgia everything I thought I'd missed. Then I moved in 1991 to Los Angeles, the Fairfax District, where the first time she came to visit, so now you're seeing me reconstruct reality because it wasn't Pico Robertson. Then I moved to 1991 to Los Angeles, the Fairfax District, where the first time she came to visit, my mother declared with a mix of dismay and disbelief, "You've moved to Brooklyn in the 1940s. She was referring to the shabby duplexes, the delis and the kosher bakeries, all the black hats on Fairfax and the side streets with their tefillin and their prayers. For me, however, it was a different kind of lens through which to reckon with the past. L.A. even had the Dodgers, a defining aspect of my grandfather's Brooklyn, and if there was little happening at Dodger Stadium that recalled Ebbets Field, there it was, in any case, another echo, another rhyme. And here's Norman again. "When I go down Figueroa," Norman Klein once told me as we ate at a taqueria in his neighborhood of Highland Park, "I literally flash back to my teenage years on Avenue U in South Brooklyn. Even though the people here are Salvadoran, I can almost see them as Jewish. I find this a lot." What he meant was that in his eyes, Los Angeles was less a unified city than a collection of microclimates, of ethnicity and layers of urban traces, one upon the other, which, whatever else it signifies, renders the place a template for our fantasies. In The History of Forgetting, Klein makes the point explicit, citing the city's history of serving as informal film set, often dressed up to resemble somewhere else. "I am not implying," he writes, "that LA's neighborhoods have no public record at all, quite the contrary. The photo archives of vernacular Los Angeles are indeed gigantic, running into millions of images. However, these cannot compete with hundreds of movie melodramas where downtown is a backdrop. Some locations are simply easier to transfigure than others for heavy equipment to be positioned or cheaper to rent, and they therefore figure more powerfully in the public record while others never appear. Indeed, Los Angeles remains the most photographed and least remembered city in the world."
So that, that
if you're gonna crib, you should always crib from someone really good.
I guess what I loved about those two passages was this, in a sense of early infatuation leaking through. I really love that. That vision, you know, that you're seeing yourself in a place, you're seeing the place itself as you are now and that you are then. And it seems like both of you are moving so much towards this quality of attention, this quality of lucidity that you bring to your walking that is so inspiring. That
sounds good.
I like that too.
We'll take that.
For me, like one of the things is I walk, I mean, I, you know, as always, we walk, or I assume, I walk different walks, but I walk the same walks. And there is a kind of quality of history, you know, quality of memory that comes up. You know, things that have happened on those walks, your own interaction with those streets. Again, for me, it's a way of rooting myself into a place. I'm always aware in any city that I'm in, whether it's a city I live in or a city that I don't, that the streets belong not just to the people in the present, but also there's ghosts everywhere. The cities, you know, people for centuries in certain cities or, you know, in this city, a century plus, have walked these streets, have walked these neighborhoods. And so all of those memories, all of those experiences, all of that kind of material, let's say, is hanging around.
So you can walk with your memories too. You can walk, you know, solving a problem too, as I often do, like with writing. And I totally love that description. Vivian has this, I've never seen anyone do this before, where you actually describe the process by which you discovered that you were daydreaming and that you weren't actually paying attention. And it's a great revelation to your writing. I thought that was
that's
quite an extraordinary moment.
A little that's a part not about me in the city, but about me trying to describe.
But also about being able to really see what you saw when you were walking, right? Which is,
well, that's included. Yes. I don't feel the ghosts.
You don't.
It's just me and the street. No, I don't. I mean, I'm aware, and there are many places in the book where I do consult history. In the sense that I say, I know that people have walked these streets before, I know this or that, but I don't feel any of that when I'm walking. When I'm walking, I'm all there. Well, this New York demands, it really demands your full attention. You can't walk as a serious walker and feel nostalgic on the street. You really have to, you just can't.
Or you'll crash into someone on a cell phone.
Or you crash into someone on their phone.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, you got to keep your eyes open.
Right.
And and be ready to hear and ready to move fast. Once, not so long ago, I was standing on the corner of 34th and 6th or 7th Avenues, and it was an incredibly busy thoroughfare. And the light was changing. A young woman was standing next to me, and a man much older than me was trying to walk across the street. He started across and the light changed. And we both felt at the same moment that the cars were starting and he was tottering and the light had changed in favor of the cars. And we were sure that he was going to get hit. And she said to me, "Boy, this is no city for the old," which isn't true. It really isn't true. This is no city for an old man. But I mean, I felt the same startled sense of, you got to be all here all the time. It's not true. It is a city for the old. I mean, I wouldn't grow old in any other place in the world, because once you stop being able to drive a car, in car culture, you're not in such great shape as you can totter across the street in New York until you're 110.
If you can deal with ice, you can grow old in New York, right? I'm going to open it up to questions in just a minute, but I was also really struck, Vivian, you had the beautiful description in your book of New York after 9/11, you know, the quality on the street. And I was wondering if there's an equivalent, I mean, not that there's an equivalent, but I was trying to think of moments in L.A. where that the whole city was stunned into some kind of collective. And I remember that after the Rodney King verdict, I remember it after the earthquake. Yeah.
The earthquakes,
yeah.
I imagine.
Well,
pull you all together.
Yeah.
It's interesting because the first LA book I did, which was an anthology that City Lights published, in fact, you were in that anthology, in 2001, the publication date of that book was Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. And we did the first reading for that book on the 12th. Mm. And basically, there was no reading. It was the handful of us who came out, many of whom had lived in or had some experience with New York, talking about our sense of dislocation from the tragedy. It was a book soup. So there we were on the Sunset Strip, about as far as you can imagine from Lower Manhattan. It was weird and quiet and surreal, but not disrupted, physically disrupted. And I realized in that moment, this is about 10 years after I'd moved to Los Angeles, that I was no longer a New Yorker. Mm. I was a New Yorker in terms of my heritage, but that I had missed some kind of cataclysmic, I think cataclysmic coming together in a certain way, yeah. Right, as a response yes. to that. And I began to think about what makes one a resident of any city. I realized that in some way, I began to become an Angeleno, although I hesitate to call myself, I wouldn't call myself a native because I'm not native born. So I actually use the phrase lifer also, mm-hmm. but in a different sense. But I began to become an Angeleno or a lifer and whatever in the wake of the whole series of cataclysms of the 1990s. The earthquake being one, Rodney King and the riots being the first, the earthquake being one, OJ, that whole sort of period. And I think that in some ways we come together or we find out what we are as a community and as people by how we deal with catastrophe. And those things do bring us together. And for me at least, being here and being part of those events, part of a community, whether the personal community of myself and my family, my friends, or the broader community of the city, and in the case of New York, being right. not part of that, it's a sick and pathetic thing to say, but in some ways, I've always regretted that I wasn't mm-hmm. in Manhattan on mm-hmm. September 11th. I think those things bind us to a place and are really important, right? It's not the, yeah. We learn in catastrophe and tragedy what means, what's important to us. Sorry to bring it down.
That's okay. That's okay.
No.
I just want to thank you both for these two remarkable books that not just make me think about my own city, what it means to be alive in a city and to be among other people in a community. So I want to thank you for this beautiful work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sure we have some questions out here. There's some hands.
Louise knows I come here all the time. I have never heard a conversation that speaks to me more than this one. I am a Brooklyn-born New York native who lives walking distance from Burbank and Fulton. this conversation has my head's exploding. But my question is, the stories you describe are so visual. I'm seeing you on 6th Avenue near Bryant Park and a man's lying in the street. So my question is very specific. Where in Brooklyn did you grow up? Where in the Bronx did you grow up? I want to picture the neighborhoods because I can picture the places you describe, but not where you grew up. And that's important to me. And where did your parents come from, Vivian?
I didn't grow up in Brooklyn. I'm the product of my parents' cosmopolitan Manhattan fantasy. So I grew up on the Upper East Side, where they escaped Brooklyn to become, to transform themselves into yes. something different. My parents, my mother grew up in Flatbush and went to Midwood High School. And
mine did too.
Right. So, and my father, who never talked, I'm serious. I don't know where he lived in Brooklyn because he refuses to utter the word Brooklyn. So,
wow.
Even now?
Even now. But they moved to Elmont. They left Brooklyn and moved to Elmont in 48, 49.
Mm-hmm. And Vivian, where did you grow up in the Bronx?
I grew up in the East Bronx in the West Farms Road district, right around the corner from the Bronx Zoo.
Oh, wow.
That's where I grew up.
And where did your parents come from?
My mother came from the Ukraine and my father from Bessarabia, which was a province that went back and forth between Romania and Russia.
Thank you. Thank you. I have enjoyed this thoroughly. Thank you.
I'm glad.
Yep.
Vivian, when you were speaking about finding yourself in walking around Manhattan, I began to think about all of my friends who live in Manhattan or New York and leave for the weekend. And I was thinking about how nature is so involved in Los mm-hmm. Angeles. And so I was just wondering if both of you might talk a little bit about the relationship of
That nature?
Is city in nature, nature, nature. Because many people would say that they find themselves in nature.
Well, not we don't.
Okay, that's
it. I mean, my book is a demonstration of the exact opposite. I'm with Lewis Mumford. For me, nature is the city. It's the human habitation. The rest is for animals. I mean, well, that's true, isn't it?
Well, you do live with the pigeons, though. You do live with
You do the pigeons, not me. Pigeons. I don't do anything on four legs or actually, my neighborhood, Greenwich Village, is filled with trees. And it's only once every 10 years that I remember to look up and see them. When the spring, they're very beautiful in the spring. And but I almost always, for me, the city is at eye level, and I almost never see the trees. But actually, every now and then. But I am like my immigrant parents. I mean, my father. We used to go to the Catskill Mountains in the summers, because all these slum dwellers, you know, said it's good for the children. And we would go for 2 weeks to the Catskill Mountains, and they would hire a car, and we would go up with all his pots and pans and all this stuff. And halfway up, when I was about to throw up from my father would say, let's get out of the car. We'd get out of the car. He would smell the air and say in Yiddish, smell the air. And then he'd say, okay, that's enough, back in the car. And that is how I grew up. Yeah. And we had no relation to, but when I'm in deep country, I'm dazzled and love it for 10 minutes.
And I will say, this is serious. This sounds like hyperbole, but it's actually true. Growing up in Manhattan, I was about 15 years old before I realized that Manhattan was outside. You know, it's constantly paved. Like there was, you know, I think I stumbled upon a construction site and there was dirt. And it was like a revelation. I was like, oh, there's dirt. This is, there's nature, right? This is built on something. It never occurred to me at all that it was, I actually thought Central, I mean, I didn't think this quite consciously, but emotionally, I felt like Central Park had been built on top of this concrete.
Yeah. Well, you're right.
Construction as a sort of, you know, nature preserve in a certain way. It never occurred to me that that was part of the natural flora and fauna. And speaking of the trees, you know, one of the things I love about Los Angeles is jacaranda season, but I always miss it until the, you know, it's always halfway through when I see, you know, it's when the leaves, the purple has fallen off the trees and is starting to rot that I notice it. And then I think, damn, I missed it again.
And
I say I'm going to pay attention and I never
And you know what
do.
They say, the jacaranda is a very beautiful tree to have in your neighbor's yard.
Is it? That's good.
Next question.
Is this on? I wanted to know if you've ever made either mental notes or written about the relative friendliness of different cities in terms of passing people and smiling and nodding and those kinds of acknowledgments, because I find that colors your experience, one's experience in a city. I grew up in New York, and when I moved to Seattle in the early 90s, I just remember being so struck by how many more people would meet you, your eyes and nod and smile, even say hello. I mean, it was an utterly new experience there in the Northwest. And anyway, and you know, now also, I guess we're in the era of smartphones and people talking to themselves, you know, so maybe that has changed too. So I guess, if you've noticed that, either differences.
Oh, of course.
Also, there's the silent experience, which you described with the woman, the girl when you were young. And then there's also the actual, you know, random conversations you have. But any thoughts on that?
I have many thoughts on that. I have worked as a teacher in MFA programs all over the country. I have experienced exactly what you're talking about many places. Houston, Texas, and Pennsylvania, and everywhere imaginable. The politeness, the graciousness, good morning, good evening, et cetera. And people being startled by my over-directness, taking it as an aggression so that I learned to come to, you know, to back off, et cetera. None of it interested me for 5 minutes. And I'll tell you, it didn't. Because it wasn't true. It was just a habit of public, not even courtesy, just a habit that people inhabited without thinking, and it didn't indicate any kind of kindness or consideration or intelligence at all. New York is tough and rough. And last time I was out there was in Iowa last year, and a woman in a bank, a teller in a bank, when she saw that I was from New York, she shuddered. And she said, oh, I was there last year. I couldn't wait to get home. And I said, why? And she said she couldn't bear the abruptness that people did not take time to ask her how she was or whatever the hell it was. Right. The fact of the matter is, when they no matter how abrupt they are, when they open their mouths to say something, it's infinitely more interesting than it is anywhere else. So that's...
So I'll just say that in a sort of non-answer answer.
Oh,
so the best cartoon, the best New Yorker cartoon I've ever seen is a two-panel cartoon, pardon my profanity, which is about to come out, but is a two-panel cartoon with the same image in both panels, two men walking towards each other on the street and greeting each other. Under each is a caption. One says New York, one says Los Angeles. The New York one, the men are saying to each other, fuck you, but they are thinking, have a nice day. And in the Los Angeles one, they're saying, have a nice day, but they're thinking, fuck you.
Do you think that's true?
I'm not sure. I do think that actually psychically the cities have a lot in common with each other in the sense that both are destination cities, both are huge metropolitan areas, both thrive on ambition and a kind of, you know, in they're both places people throw over. Not to say that there aren't people who grow up here and stay in each place, but they're both places that in many ways are defined by people coming for some reason.
Definitely.
And that energy is rare. I mean, there's only certain kinds of cities have that sort of energy. Right.
There was also a period of time, I mean, and I think it has changed in New York in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, where it was not a good idea to look people in the eye. I mean, you wanted you know, like, especially for a woman walking alone, you did not, you know, you were not going to, like, stare at people because, you know, you didn't want to be hassled.
It was a terrible period.
Yeah.
But it's over.
Right.
It's
as a like kid, I was taught.
It's not anymore?
Not at all.
No, and as a kid, I was taught by my New Yorker mother in particular, I mean, useful skills. I was taught how to walk in, how to enter a subway car and scan for a seat or for trouble without making eye contact. These are all really good, useful skills.
My mother was unbeatable. She'd come in with both elbows swinging, and if nobody else in the car got a seat, she got a seat.
She was an expert at it. We have another question.
Oh.
I don't know if this question will work, and I'm a little nervous about it, but, you know, there's cities... In lots of countries, there's two cities that have a dynamic, you know, Sydney and Melbourne. And so it seems to me, maybe it's just an artifact of the two of you being here, but that Los Angeles and New York have that kind of dynamic. I was going to start by saying, well, you know, what do you see as the way that they shape each other? But I actually was thinking, and again, it might be an artifact of who you are and who we are, that... New York is like inserted inside of Los Angeles in a way that Angelenos can't get rid of, don't like, whatever. I mean, Los Angeles, I don't know if it's still true, but it used to be true that it was full of people who wished they were in New York. And yet,
true?
Los Angeles, in just the 30 years I've been here, has totally come of age. So I wonder if, and again, I don't know if there's any answer to this question, if either of you have ideas about the way these two cities are linked or define each other or something like that.
When I was younger, lots of people talked. When I was younger in college, certainly up to college, the sense of Los Angeles was very strong, the sense of it, as a city of glitz and ambition, as David said, and people coming out here to that was probably the people that we knew, you know, to get a hunk of glamour, to get a hunk of American glamour. At the same time, they held Los Angeles in contempt. They were coming here to make money. People like Lillian Hellman and all the writers and directors who came from New York, they would come back and make fun of the city of Los Angeles. You know how they do it in L.A. And then we'd have some crack. And But I never experienced the other way here. I know that the city is full of people who were formed whose formative years were spent in New York and in the New York milieu, and they came here, and I'm sure that they have affected the flavor, the tone, and a lot of many parts of LA. But I never experienced it the other way. The Los Angeles part seemed to fade. By the time I was really grown up, I never felt anybody talking about it or thinking about it or going out to Los Angeles except to become part of the movie industry for no other reason except you.
I mean, I think of my grandparents moving here in 1941 and like that was a really bold thing for a, you know, 50 couple in their 50s to do, to start all over again, who were immigrants to begin with. But it had such an allure to them. And I have my father's letters from coming to visit them for the first time, and that, you know, talk about infatuation. That first, you know, they planted orange trees at Union Station so that when, you know, you got off the train, you know, you were, you were literally, you know, in the spell.
Right.
It was all there.
But I think it's, you know, really, you know, I'll fall back on what I know best, but I think it's really a matter of who controls the narratives. Right. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about Los Angeles.
Excellent point.
As, you know, not to just say it as excellent a literary landscape, but for the first part, really, actually, until Wanda, you know, the first part of the big first two thirds of the 20th century, the narratives about Los Angeles were almost entirely narratives of exile or narratives of outsiders commenting on the exoticism of the place. I actually have believed that if there were palm trees in Manhattan, there would be no cult of exoticism about Los Angeles because the palm trees wouldn't be exotic. There'd be nothing to be exotic about. So I think that in the first place, you have a lot of people who came out for exactly those reasons, right? To make money in Hollywood. They lived in a kind of enclave and judged the place on the basis of terms, right? There's a great, actually I love this essay, but I love it both because it's beautiful and also because it's ridiculous. This essay Truman Capote wrote called Hollywood, where he talks about the fact that, you know, he talks about the ridiculousness of Christmas in Beverly Hills, right? But if we think climactically, the weather in Beverly Hills at Christmas is probably much closer to the weather in Bethlehem at Christmas than the weather in Connecticut, right? In some way.
I think so there's
that question.
Too.
And
true.
I think it's really only when there's really only when Angelenos start telling their own stories that Los Angeles begins to emerge as a culture in its own right, which is not, I mean, yes, there's a strong transplant element to the development of Los Angeles historically and continue. But there is also a strong sort of local component to the history of the city and to the personality of the city, which only begins to emerge at least in my reading, in the narratives with someone like Wanda Coleman, who really changes the literature. I mean, I think in many ways, we can't say enough about her, single-handedly in many ways, changes the literature from a literature of exile to a literature of place and begins to return the narratives to the city, to the neighborhoods, to the communities, to the people who grew up here. And I think that that's one of the reasons that in many ways the contemporary stories that we read about Los Angeles, the contemporary literature of Los Angeles is defined by those kind of personal stories, by stories that undercut or exist beneath the surface of the mythic trope. Mm-hmm. Because the myths are so prevalent, what's the revolutionary aesthetic act? To tell the personal story. And so Los Angeles is emerging. I also think it's really important to think about the fact that Los Angeles as a kind of, for want of a better phrase, like an American city, I mean, in the terms of a United States city, a city as part of the United States, is a very young city. It's a creation, for the most part, its development is a creation of the 20th century. So it's a city that is in a very much of a developmental stage, whereas some of these other cities we're talking about, certainly New York, or you know, are more developed. If you look at photographs of New York 100 years ago, it looks recognizably like New York. If you look at photographs of Los Angeles 100 years ago,
the desert.
It looks like, I mean, there's a great photo from 1908 of the corner of Crescent Heights and Sunset, and it's a farm, you know? I mean, that's kind of amazing.
So you think New York has not? So you would say, too, that New York has not really influenced?
No, I think it absolutely influenced it, but I think that as Los Angeles begins to come into its own, and I agree, like in the 30s, I've lived here for 25 years, I've never seen a city transform so much in a period of time as this city is, for better or for worse. I'm not I mean, I think for better, but it could go either way, right? But I think that Los Angeles we're still finding out, and that as the city kind of settles and it becomes more itself, what we're getting now are the city is controlling its own narratives, or the city is defining its own narratives, rather than the city's narratives being defined from the outside. So I think that's one.
And it's
one
become, difference. And I think more narratives are coming in that we haven't heard before.
Yes, or are being allowed. I think right. They were always, many of them were here, but they are actually, they're getting airspace now. They're being allowed, we're allowed to hear them, or we have access to them.
The other night, Viet Nguyen was talking about, he just won the Pulitzer, about this being, for himself as a Vietnamese writer, he said, we've been living in an era of narrative scarcity. There aren't that many stories of people who came here from Vietnam, but now they're starting to be told,
right.
Or they're starting to be heard. So it's an exciting time in that way, I think, in Los Angeles for a multiplicity of voices that.
So the kind of narratives you're talking about would be immigrant narratives. So are these immigrant narratives entwined with
and native born too, second generation too, I think.
Right, both. Community narratives from neighborhoods, narratives of I think. What does Waldy call it? Sacred ordinariness, right? Mm-hmm. The idea of, that this is not, I mean, yes, all landscapes are mythic if we look at them through that filter, but this is also a huge, vast city in which, the greater, right, metropolitan area, 20 million people live in greater Los Angeles,
sure.
Give or take. So this is also just a sort of place where people go to work. And, it's always interesting to me that we kind of overlook that sometimes when we think about Los Angeles in these mythic terms. That it's just, like everybody here, right? It was a pain in the ass to get through traffic to get down here today, right?
So unless you
that's
walk.
Part of the struggle,
unless
in a way. I'm not saying that as a cliche. It's just a reality of, it's like you had to leave. You had to, so that in the same way that we're dealing with logistics, like in New York, I'm like, how many people are going to be on the subway if I take the subway now? Maybe I'll walk, right? You're engaged in a relationship with the space and with the place and with its terms. I often think when I lived in, when I really knew I became an Angeleno, the whole time I lived in New York, I would periodically, maybe many, many times a day, have outbursts where I'd be like, oh, I hate this city. It's completely unworkable. And then at a certain point, I started saying that about Los Angeles, and I was like, I'm home.
I want to thank our distinguished writers here for coming. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I wish I could serve you all Manhattans, but I can't. So we'll join you in the lobby in just a moment. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.